This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. If I say immigration, you think what? Hot button political issue? For many Americans, it is the story of their lives. For generations, parents, sons, and daughters have packed up in search of what they hope will be a better life here in the U.S. While Latino immigrants are often the subject of the headlines, today we hear from a novelist who has brought the African immigrant experience to new life in a new novel. Author Taye Selassie's debut novel is Ghana Must Go, and it follows the triumphs and struggles of one African immigrant family. Selassie has been hailed as a rising literary star. We first spoke with her in 2011 when the journal Granta published her short story, The Sex Lives of African Girls. And Taye Selassie is with us once again, only now she's here in our Washington, D.C. studios in person. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back. Congratulations.
So good to be back. Thank you.
Do you mind telling us, I do want to dig into the story, but I did want to ask just about how you started writing. I mean, sort of looking at your resume, your CV, which is quite impressive and quite intimidating, actually. Born in London, raised in Massachusetts, you have a BA in American Studies from Yale, an MPhil in International Relations from Oxford. Looking at that CV, one might think diplomat. Doesn't necessarily scream,
novelist. No.
So tell me why.
Absolutely. I've known since the age of 4 years old that I wanted to be a writer. To be honest, in fear mostly, I went to Yale and I didn't study creative writing there. And then I went on to Oxford thinking that I could apply my passion for writing to a career in journalism, only to find, as I think many creative people do, that the passion would not go quietly into that good night or that small box. And eventually...
Well, yes, we do frown on making things up. True.
When I was young, my mother always said, Taye, you are very good at telling stories. And I think she meant that I was an abject liar, but I took it to mean that I was a future novelist.
Well, and so you are.
And so I am.
The book opens with the death of a family patriarch, Kwaku Sai. He is a talented surgeon. His wife is accomplished in her own right, had the opportunity to go to law school. She becomes a homemaker. Mm-hmm. They then create together this beautiful family. And, of course, things happen.
It
all goes bust in a certain way. What brought you this story?
I wish I knew. I've told the anecdote. I was at a yoga retreat in Sweden when these characters sort of appeared to me. I think probably the longer, deeper, truer story is that they'd been on their way for a very long time. And when they finally manifest themselves, I knew on some level this was a story worthy of the form of a novel. And Wikipedia will tell you that the lives of these characters bear many surface similarities to the lives of my family. So my father's a Ghanaian surgeon. My mother is Nigerian and Scottish. My twin sister went to Harvard Med and studied at Hopkins. We both went to Yale, as does the youngest daughter, Sadie, and so forth. But those really are details. The similarities between the Sai family and my family are superficial, though abundant. And this is in every way their story and not mine.
Would you just please just read a little bit, just to set this up. This is the patriarch, Kwaku Sai, reflecting back on his life. Here it is.
To escape would have sufficed. To be free, if one wants swelling strings, to be human, beyond being citizen, beyond being poor. It was all he was after in the end, a human story, a way to be Kwaku beyond being poor. To have somehow unhooked his little story from the larger ones, the stories of country and of poverty and of war, that had swallowed up the stories of the people around him and spat them up, faceless, nameless villagers, cogs. To have fled, thus unhooked, on the small SSI, for the vastness and smallness of life free of want, the petty triumphs and defeats of the self, profession, family, versus those of the state, grinding work, civil war. Yes, this would have been quite enough, Kwaku thinks. Born in dust, dead in grass, progress, distant shore reached.
I'm glad you read that, because there are so many things I want to talk to you about. First is that you established Kwaku quite early on as a person who has a very intense consciousness about his own life. Mm-hmm. And you even create this kind of image of the unseen cinematographer,
right,
that
cameraman.
He has, this cameraman in his mind that he has kind of following him around, documenting his life. How did you come up with that?
Well, the cameraman appears fourth paragraph of the novel. And I remember when I was writing, I'd escaped said yoga retreat in Sweden to go to Copenhagen, and I was typing the first 10 pages there. And when I got to that fourth paragraph, I typed those words and I actually started laughing out loud. That's sort of ridiculous. But it resonated on some level as true of certain people. And I think particularly certain men who are as concerned about how they seem to others as they are with how they appear to themselves.
Well, you know, it's true. I think there are a lot of people who feel that they know people who are constantly posing for someone. And you think, who are you posing to? But I also wondered if you think that's part of that experience of the first to do something, or the one from the village who makes good. And as you say, there's something about that experience that leads to that, you know, what Du Bois called the double consciousness.
That's right. That begets that sense of an audience, for sure. I think that so much of Kweku's life from the time that he leaves that village in Kokrobite is based on this journey. First of all, there's the fact that he feels guilty that he left, though his mother didn't want him to. And with that guilt, I think, comes the need to prove to himself, probably also to her, that it was the right thing to do, that leaving behind the family that had raised him in order to create the one that he himself raises is the right decision to have made. He gives so much of himself, and so much of his identity comes from that project, that I think the other parts of his identity, including his moral code, his sense of self, these things, I think, are subjugated in many ways to his desire to make good.
You portray a very vivid, let me just say, you've created some very vivid characters and some very vivid situations, some of which will be very familiar to anybody who has been an immigrant, who has struggled, anybody who's really been to college, frankly, who understands people who are kind of striving and trying to get someplace.
That's
on the other hand, there's some really disturbing and extreme things that happen
for sure
to some of the people in the book. And I'm not sure how much to give away, but as a mother of twins, I'm particularly struck and disturbed by
what
something
happens
that scenario to the twins,
yeah,
who seem to become the victims of a relative where they're sent to study. Maybe you can help me here, because I'm not sure how much you want to give away.
I can say this. I think probably one of the biggest questions that I suspect readers will have about the novel is the question that I had myself. And I don't think it's giving too much away to say, is it right, is it accurate that Fola would have sent her twins to Nigeria for that year?
Fola being the mom of the twins.
I should say Fola being
Kweku's wife, and after the marriage falls apart, she has difficulty supporting the kids in the way that she feels they deserve, and so she sends them to a relative.
That's right.
And, you know, that is a sort of a familiar circumstance. But what happens to them there is very disturbing.
It's horrific, and it's devastating, not just for the twins, but for the entire family. I think that decision, it can really only be understood within the context that Fola is operating in. So three things. Number one, West African immigrants, and not just, but I can speak specifically of West African immigrants, often send their children to family members and don't perceive it in the same way that I think perhaps an American family would perceive that, as sending your kids away. So for example, my cousin Ohirame was sent to our uncle in Nigeria from his mom's house in Greenwich, not necessarily because my aunt was unable to take care of him, but because she thought there were better opportunities for him to go live with our uncle in Nigeria. And this kind of sending of children to family members happens all the time. It's also at the heart of Sex Lives of African Girls, the short story that I spoke with you about. But one of the things that I think I might be critiquing in that practice is something that is very fundamental to brown families, which is that I think we often have such a fundamental trust in our family members that we fail to see those family members who are quite simply dangerous. Number two, Fola is aware that her half-brother is into some unsavory things, let's say, and she sends her twins anyway. It's a heartbreaking decision, and I've really asked myself, why would she have done that? And it's interesting. Fola at that moment, but at other moments in the novel, is suffering from what I think any middle-class Western female reader could probably readily identify as depression. But it's something that a Nigerian woman raised, as Fola was until 13 years old in Nigeria and then entirely without parents, wouldn't necessarily recognize in herself, because this type of mental illness and these kinds of psychological difficulties are not as freely discussed or attended to in our culture. This is, I would argue, this is just the truth. And so when Fola's last baby is born and almost dies, again, this happens very early and is giving nothing away, she goes into a depression. She locks herself in a room. The children are left to sort of feed themselves and get themselves to school. And I think when Kwaku leaves the family, she goes into another depression and she's not thinking straight. She is bereft and she is in a sort of shutdown mode. She's just trying to figure out how to get these kids to succeed, despite the fact that they don't have a lot of money anymore.
I'm speaking with Taye Selassie. We're talking about her debut novel, Ghana Must Go. It's already garnered some rave reviews. I do have to ask you this, though. You are already quite celebrated as a beginning novelist, but and as a very mature voice. Your initial story that was published in Granta was rave reviews. This book's already getting wonderful reviews. I do have to wonder, though, as an expatriate, as a person who was raised outside of Africa for most of your life, you are one of a number of expatriate authors who are getting a lot of attention for your depiction of conditions in Africa and of the conditions of immigrants. And I just sort of wonder, there's the whole dirty laundry question. And I wonder if you feel any special responsibility, any special burden? No. No. Just answer. No.
No. As a novelist, I ask of myself only that I tell the truth and that I tell it beautifully. Those are the two standards to which I hold my writing. Is it true and is it beautiful? I don't mean to suggest that at 33 years old, I know everything that there is to know about the truth. But I try to see what resonates with me as true. I ask myself, and I ask these questions with recourse to my education in international relations, to my education embedded in my family for the past 3 decades, to my education as an observer of human experience, wherever I found it. Looking at these things, I say, does this resonate as true? And if the answer is yes, then I feel no compunction whatsoever about putting it down on the page as beautifully as I can.
You have an interesting scene in the book where one of Kwaku's children, Olu, the oldest, the son who follows in his father's footsteps as a surgeon, develops a very deep and loving relationship with a woman who's Chinese American. And there was a certain point at which he decides, is it okay if I say this? Decides
Absolutely.
To go to her,
her dad
to Dr. ask Wei. His hand for her hand, which, you know, even though they're very modern, but he thought this would be respectful to do. And Dr. Wei basically tells him in rather blunt terms why he does not give his blessing, because he basically feels that African men are not good fathers. And he says, you know, he basically lays it out. Like, do you want to say it, what he says?
Yeah, absolutely. Shall I read what Dr. Wei says?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Little paragraph?
I think people would enjoy that.
You know, I never understood the dysfunctions of Africa, the greed of the leaders, disease, civil war, still dying of malaria in the 21st century, still hacking and raping, cutting genitals off, young children and nuns slitting throats with machetes, those girls in the Congo, this thing in Sudan. As a young man in China, I assumed it was ignorance, intellectual incapacity, inferiority, perhaps. Needless to say, I was wrong, as I've noted. When I came here, I saw I was wrong. Fair enough. But the backwardness persists even now, and why is that? When African men are so bright, as we've said. And the women, too, don't get me wrong, I'm not sexist. But why is that place still so backward, I ask. And you know what I think? No respect for the family. The fathers don't honor their children or wives. The Olu I knew, Oluwaleku Nobayomi, had 2 bastard children, plus 3 by the wife. A brain without equal, but no moral backbone. That's why you have the child soldier, the rape. How can you value another man's daughter or son when you don't even value your own?
Ouch.
Yeah, that was tough. That was tough. I can see myself typing that out. And Dr. Wei, this Chinese father, ends with that question, how can you value another man's daughter or son when you don't even value your own? And I paused. I remember I leaned away from the laptop and I was like, tell him why you mad, son. But
do you have an answer?
No, I don't. because while Dr. Wei is speaking in a hugely reductive, in a hugely generalizing, in a hugely stereotyping manner, he is also touching, in so doing, on some things that are true. And my father left our family. He certainly assumed that my mother would raise us almost entirely by herself, as she did, to spectacular effect. This is true for, I would say, about 70% of the West African women I know. We've been raised by our mothers, even those who have remained married to fathers, fathers who have stayed home on the continent or who have been absent emotionally from the household. And Dr. Wei's question, why is that, is one that I'm not sure I can answer.
Well,
so, but I can say it's one that as a novelist, I do feel obliged to ask.
Well, all is not misery in this any means. So I just want to say that. Thank you for this. And I know that this will not only be the first of what I know will be a brilliant career. So I hope you'll come back and see us when you write the next
book. Oh, it would be my absolute
pleasure. What do you mind if I ask? I know writers hate this. All artists hate it when you ask them this question.
What's
your next book about? But that question, no, actually, I was going to ask, what do you hope people will draw from this one?
I hope that readers of Ghana Must Go will enjoy the music of it. I hope that they will enjoy what Francine Duplessis Gray calls the tonality, the tonal texture of it. And I hope that they will feel the words sort of flowing past them or washing over them in the way that I did when I was writing it.
Taye Selassie's debut novel is titled Ghana Must Go, and she was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me again.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.